The Nightingale Conant Corporation presents Spiritual Awakening. Excerpts from a series of live lectures by Ram Dass.
Namaste. Can everyone hear? How nice. That's a good beginning.
Can everyone see?
Does everyone know? I, like you, probably, really get sucked in by the worldly things. It's all so fascinating. Will we, won't we, can we, can't we, should we, shouldn't we? I mean, CNN keeps saying, listen to me, listen to me. I'll tell you what's real. Yeah. Because of the urgency of everything and the nature of suffering in the world and the visibility of it all, it's really hard to keep centered, to keep quiet, to get into the place from which there is clarity and there is openness of heart. To bring to bear in life the wisdom and consciousness that we all have touched and know is possible. What we will reflect about in terms of some words is, what is the nature of spiritual awareness? What is it we awaken to? How we learned it? Why we think we aren't realized? Is there anything to do about it? And let's make believe there is something to do about it and do it. If that's all too esoteric, relax, it'll all become clear. If truths are simple enough, they should be understood across the board. They shouldn't be that esoteric. First of all, just to put all of you at ease, just because I sit up here on these cushions surrounded by flowers in white, please understand that I am all too human. I'm obviously the Buddha just like you are, but I too do not know it. So I get angry, I get depressed, I get everything. I screw up in human relationships. I get caught in being a neurotic achiever. I just want you to know what you've signed on for. So when I say things, would you please take them lightly and run them through your own intuitive heart? We are all on a journey of truth together. And I don't have it any more than you do, so I just say it well. I am, as I usually say, a rent-a-mouth. And that makes it much easier, okay? Because when something doesn't feel good, you don't have to feel it's your inadequacy. Just feel it's mine. Now, there is something that we all know that brings us together, that makes it relevant for us. And every individual here arrived at that awareness that there was something other than maybe what the culture thinks there is, or what they thought that it was. Everybody arrives there in their own unique way. It's interesting, we're all in this room, but see how, what different paths we arrived here through, what different moments of awakening, and you get a sense, at least I do, of a certain kind of evolutionary readiness in individuals. It's clear that everybody who got a divorce didn't awaken. Everybody that had an accident didn't awaken. Everybody that lost a business didn't awaken. Everybody that heard music didn't awaken. Everybody that saw a passion flower didn't awaken. So what was it about you that made you ripe for that? As they point out in the East, even a leaf falling at the appropriate moment will do it if you're ripe. And if you're not ripe, the whole tree can fall on you and nothing happens at all. So while we can, we don't have to get into it too deeply, let's just recognize that there are individual differences in readiness to awaken. And that's not blame for those that don't, and it's no reward for those that do. It's just a different kind of an incarnation. It just means you have different work to do. I mean, for most of the society, being here today with somebody named Ram Dass doing this process would seem irrelevant. And that just means they have a different agenda. And it took me a long time before I stopped putting people down because they had a different agenda. And the reason I put them down was because I was very insecure about my own. And as you get more secure about what you're doing, you are more compassionate towards others for what they're doing. Now, what is it we awakened to? What did we figure out? Or what do we know that, or what do we have an inkling of? There are a lot of things that we know or that we recognize, and we recognize them at different depths of reality. Some things we intellectually know, we somehow know they're true, but we haven't yet, what Heinlein used to call grok, we haven't grokked them, we haven't internalized them, we haven't become one with them. There are things that happened to me in March of 1961 when I first took psilocybin. In one moment, so many thousands of things happened that 30 years later, I am still growing into what happened to me that day. And I know some of those things, or I know them, but I don't know them. I intellectually know them, but I don't live as if I knew them. Most of us know more than we live as if we did. It's very frustrating at times. I mean, I kid about it, like we're all one, but it's my television set. You know? How do we integrate all of the levels of the realities that we have touched and that we know? Those of you that have had a near-death experience have gone out of your body. How do you integrate that so that you are, as Christ said, in the world but not of the world? What does that mean to integrate it? Many of us, I mean, have sensed our interdependence. We've even sensed, like, the concept of Gaia. We've heard the statement, think like a mountain. But how many of us do? How many of us can get out of our egocentric predicament to really experience our identity as part of a system? We can intellectually know that's true, but we don't act as if it were. I don't know about you, but this is my predicament. And it bugs me. Now, one of the things that I began to appreciate was that I was born through blessings or whatever into this particular society, which has certain kinds of myths, certain kinds of techniques of socialization that in an interesting way left me out of balance. It's the best way to say it. That is, when I was born, my parents, out of the best intentions, trained me to be a member of this culture. What that meant was I was trained to be an individual trained to value individuality. I was trained into separateness, into being somebody. I was trained to identify myself with my ego. And the ego is a structure of mind. It's a map of reality. And I was trained to become somebody. Now, sometime before that, before the socialization started in earnest, I didn't have a differentiated self. And had the socialization been different, I might have learned my separate self without losing that other thing, without losing the fact that I was part of everything. Now, the awakening is the realization that that whole constellation of thoughts of who you think you are is a very limiting condition, that you are much, much, much more than that. As Trungpa Rinpoche said, enlightenment is the ego's ultimate disappointment. It's the realization that who you think you are is really kind of, it's just a functional unit within a limited scope of reality. Is this too weird for everybody? If it is, just vomit or something. I don't know. And at first, when I started to recognize that who I thought I was wasn't who I was, that even the concept of I was very suspect, I saw the entire plane of reality in which I was a somebody as abhorrent. And I wanted to get away from it. I wanted to get high as fast as I could, as often as I could, and stay there as long as I could. This, I'm sure, is alien to all of you, but it's what happened to me. And it took me many years to realize, A, that I couldn't stay high, and that B, high wasn't free. And that finally I wanted to be free, I didn't want to be high. And that free meant there were no aversions and no attractions that caught you. And I saw that I found being an incarnate as a separate entity, as a neurotic somebody doing something among other somebodies, very aversive. And I had to eat that alive. I had to get through that one. I had to turn around and honor my incarnation instead of treating it as some abysmal error that somebody made, as many of you do, I suspect, from time to time. You think, how did I get stuck in this one? Who made this terrible error? Why is my suffering so... How did I end up with those parents? My God, I was sexually abused. Poor me. Instead of the flip of saying, wow, what a training course for enlightenment. See, that was the other way that it flipped around. Once I realized that the incarnation wasn't an error, I said, well, what's it doing here? How did I get stuck in it? Did I get stuck in it by mistake? And it began to slowly sink in that I had not gotten stuck in it by mistake. The nature of what I was stuck in was the projections of my own karma.
and that as I ate it, I would be finished with it, as I digested it, and then I would be free by honoring my karma rather than treating it as some error. Now, by karma, I mean the predispositions of mind that underlie attractions and aversions. Where those come from, it's very complicated. They come from genetics, they come from probably previous incarnations, they come from who knows what. But you and I, if we look at any single thing, not one of us sees it exactly the same way. And the way you see it and the way I see it, the differences are our karma made manifest. So that one of us is in a world, we say, isn't this heaven? Another says, this is hell. And we're in the same world. So it is our karma that we got lost, for most of us, and it is our karma that we awakened. And that you and I are each other's karmuppance at this moment. This is it, manifest. This is it. This is it. There's no error in the... That's the other thing I mean, it blew my mind to realize that, whatever was left of it. That there is no error in the game. Nobody made a mistake. You aren't the wrong place at the wrong moment. And that's a hard one to accept, that this is perfect. Perfect? Perfect, you say? How dare you say this is perfect? Do you know what suffering I've been through? Perfect. Perfect. Do you realize what's happening to the rainforests? Perfect. Perfect. No. We may lose the humanity on Earth. Perfect. Perfect. You see the problem? You see where the mind clings? Now, perfect doesn't mean we love it or it's we'll surrender to it. It means that there is a plane of reality, at least it means for me, there is a plane of reality where when you look at things, you see that it is all exquisitely lawful. I mean, you can see law in physics, astronomy, astrology, chemistry, genetics, but when you get into your human mind, you think somehow it's all free. But thoughts are just more stuff, and all stuff is lawfully related. Your thoughts aren't coming out of a vacuum, they're coming out of previous thoughts. If I could stand back far enough and have a computer that could handle a complex enough multiple factor analysis, I could predict your next thought, in which the thought probably is, I'll choose to go to hear Ram Dass. And you really thought you chose. And if I can tell you before you chose you're going to choose to hear Ram Dass, what was the choice? See, that's what Maharaji did to me. That's Neem Karoli Baba. Are we all right thus far? Is everybody here? Is this too thick? Are we too weird? Do you want me to lighten up? What do you think? I need... There is in here a very insecure child that constantly needs reassurance. I want you to know that. I mean, many of you know this story, but just imagine the predicament this puts me in. I'll give you the short form as quickly as I can, because for some of you it's an oldie goldie. All right. It's my second trip to India. I'm doing Vipassana meditation in Bodh Gaya with maybe 100 people. After 40 days, I've had enough, and I've been invited to go to Delhi for a big Shiva celebration. I've been doing the meditation with Manindra and Goenka, and I'm invited to Delhi by Muktananda. So I say to people, sort of surreptitiously, because we're not supposed to talk, that I'm leaving. And it turns out that about 30 others want to leave with me. And so we all get aboard this bus. There are, I think, 33 of us in the driver. And we head for Delhi. On the course of it, we pass through Allahabad. Allahabad's a very sacred city. It's the place where the Kumbh Mela occurs, which is a gathering of the holy beings that come out of the mountains and out of the other planes of reality. And they all meet every 12 years at a place where the rivers come together, and they bathe at a certain planetary moment. 5 million of them bathe in the river at that moment, which is very complicated. And it's very auspicious. And they come there for about 3 months, and they camp out in this huge place. And as we're coming into the town, Danny Goleman, who had been gone off to see the Mela, says to us, gee, there's a the Mela was here. We ought to stop and see there. I said, but it's all over. I mean, everybody's gone away. He said, well, I think we should stop anyway. And I said, no. See, and I was the older person. I'm always the elder, see, because I started late, or early, I guess. I started early. I mean, even in the 60s, I was old. Now I'm 60. I finally got a senior citizen thing on a train in New Haven. It was, man said, do you want the cheaper ticket? I said, yes, of course. So, so I said, we're all tired. We've been driving for many hours, and we've got a way to go before we get to the hotel. I think we'll skip it. He said, okay, and he went back to sit down, and I was sitting there thinking, and I thought, what kind of a holy person am I? Here we are about 5 minutes from the most sacred, one of the most sacred places in India, and I'm so busy getting to the hotel that I don't want to go there. And I kind of wrestled with it, and I finally thought, oh, what the hell, we can watch the sunset there, it'll be empty, but we'll go there anyway. So I said to the driver, turn right. I just really decided I choose to go there. So we went down there and we came to the grounds, which were very barren. And as we went to pull up to a stop, one of the members yelled, there's Maharaji, there's Neem Karoli Baba. And my guru, who I hadn't been able to find since I'd been back in India the second time, was walking by the bus with another man with him, looking very nonchalant. Nobody else is around. I mean, it's just a few people in the distance. So I got hysterical, and we all got out of the bus, and I was crying and all that sort of thing that you do. Some of you don't understand about that, but that's okay. And I got my head on his foot, and he's standing with somebody urinated, so whiffs of urine are coming up, and I'm crying and laughing, and it's good India. It's real India. You know? And then he looks bored and he says, follow us, follow us. And they get into a rickshaw, a little bicycle rickshaw, and drive down the street. And we get into this big bus following this little rickshaw down the street and down narrower streets and narrower streets. And we finally come to this house, and he gets out of the rickshaw with this other man, and they go into the house, and we get down from the bus. And as I walk up on the porch, I smell smells of Indian food, and these people come out and they say, well, welcome, we've been waiting for you. He said, waiting for us? They said, yes, Maharaji woke us early this morning and said, hurry up, start preparing food. There'll be 34 people here for dinner. Now, if he did that at 7 in the morning, who did I think I was at 5 in the afternoon who said, I think I'll turn right? I mean, you see the predicament.
Now, just take that and assume that all of our lives are like that all the time. It's interesting. I think I'll, you know. It makes it all kind of humorous, doesn't it? I mean, I can't quite take myself as seriously as I used to after an experience like that. So, part of what I know is that the part of me that is form, which is my body and my thoughts, my senses, are all a lawful unfolding of stuff. And to the extent I identify with that, I am just happening. And then I ask myself, is there anything that isn't me as I know it? Is there anything that isn't my body, my senses, my thinking mind? And therein lies the question that draws you into the domain of being that lies behind knowing. It lies behind your thinking mind. And that's what meditation is. It draws you back in to the domain where you just are, but you don't know you know, you just are. And you learn that every time you try to stand anywhere, you immediately grab something, and that something is something which is changing all the time. And that's another great wisdom, what Buddha calls anicca, that everything is changing all the time. The body's decaying, thoughts and feelings are changing all the time, it's all changing. And every time you try to lay up your treasures where moth and rust doth corrupt, as Christ said, if every time you try to invest in things which change and make it stay, there is fear, because there is a knowledge in you that it is all corrupting all the time, or changing, or mutating. And therefore you say, is there any place I can stand where everything isn't changing? And the answer is no. But you can stand nowhere. But anywhere you stand is still a place or a thing, and that will change. There are some masters in our culture who have dealt with teaching us not to stand anywhere. They lighten it up by undercutting where you're standing with the mind. They use the mind, it's like a Zen koan. It pits the mind against the mind, and it keeps loosening you and loosening you. And one of the masters that I have found is a man named Groucho Marx. And here's an example of how he does it. And just look at it as a practice. One morning, I shot an elephant in my pajamas. How he got in my pajamas, I don't know. See what happened to your mind just then? Then we tried to remove the tusks, but they were embedded so firmly, we couldn't budge them. Of course, in Alabama, the Tuscaloosa. We took some pictures of the native girls, but they were not developed. But we're going back again. Coming back to the issue of boundaries just for a couple of minutes, and balance, rather. You start out undifferentiated, you develop somebodyness. The somebodyness you develop, who you think you are, defines boundaries, because everything you don't think you are, you're not in your mind. And that's what's called, Gurdjieff calls, the prison of the mind. And you settle into your little prison cell, and that's reality. And then awakening occurs, and you realize you have been imprisoned in your own mind, and that who you are is much richer than your conceptual structure of reality.
And as I said, what I attempted to do it then was push away, go out of my mind, to get out of the structure. And I realized that the structure was not inherently bad. What was the problem, or not the problem, but what was my karma, was how caught I had gotten in reducing life to being only that. And that ultimately the balance was to be in the world but not of the world, to have the spacious awareness that has no definition, that has no form, that is free, and out of that freedom have a form and use ego and use it as a functional entity to function within this world, so that the ego goes from being your master to being your servant. That's a shift. It's a major shift. And I've recognized something else that I think you probably have too, that there are components of our being that are various receptors that work very well for different parts. For example, our intellectual analytic mind is the absolute exquisite controller and servant and protector of our separateness. That if you are Doris or Harry or Fred or Bill, the ego structure, the mind, is constantly, because the mind thinks about objects, it's constantly defining boundaries, and this is this and this is not this, and it's constantly defining a way to protect you as a separate entity. The other part that's interesting is what would be called the intuitive heart. And the intuitive heart is that part that has no boundaries. The statement, my heart goes out to you. It's the quality of love that doesn't have boundary. It's a merging quality. It's I am one with all things. You need it, you use it. And the heart says, here, you take it. And the mind says, what do you mean? You have your health insurance to pay. And there's this dialogue that goes on in us between our minds and our hearts, between our love and our reason. And the predicament is that they end up in a strange way at war with each other. And we are ripped apart because they are both parts of our being. And the balance I'm talking about is the honoring of the mind and the heart. Not talking about the emotional heart, I'm talking about the deeper intuitive, what's called the hridayam, the spiritual heart, or the quality of compassionate conscious love. And you and I paid an incredibly high price to be efficient, effective, responsible, a member of an individualistic society. Because that quality of boundless love was something that we started to see as something that was chaotic and that was disruptive to the essence of our being. And we always wanted our love under control. And that's part of the neuroses of relationship. We'll talk more about this stuff later. These are all components of things that we awaken to. I mean, what I'm saying is not new to most of you. You know it as well as I do. There's no surprises in this. And there was also just the awakening to the fact of Buddha's first noble truth, that there is suffering inherent in form. And some of you are realizing, as I do, that for you individually, not for other people, but for you, the suffering can be an instrument for awakening, and it can be grace.
This is the end of side one. Side two is already queued up for your listening.